This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and here we are once again. It is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can be sent to us via radio program at AOL.com. With me, Layla Mutin. She's our nutritionist in residence. We work together at our practice in Manhattan. Have done so for well nigh, what is it, about 12 years now? Easily.
Yeah.
And,
oh, my goodness.
And here we are collaborating on our Q&A podcast going into our third year. With lots of downloads, lots of questions, and evidently some of you are listening out there, so it's really gratifying to hear that. So before we get into questions, we got, you know, some people send us heads up on stories that they'd like us to know about.
Yes.
And so can you read those couple of emails or tell us about them?
Right. We've got from Michael, as well as somebody else who sent us the same study, that new published clinical trial confirms Niagen supplementation raised nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, NAD, NAD levels, and potentially improves blood pressure and cardiovascular health. We're talking specifically about nicotinamide riboside.
Yes, and
which is very exciting.
Brand name Niacel,
yes.
Made by a company called Thorne. Thorne used to be on Fullscript, which is our online dispensary. And recently, Thorne ceased to participate in Fullscript. But if you call our office, we can give you heads up on how you can get an account directly with Thorne. And you can order directly from Thorne and get a nice discount, because it is an expensive product. But, you know, I guess the reason that they're sending it to us is to say, hey, you know, this is stuff you've been talking about for so long, and look at
right. The
new exciting results. And, of course, actually, I had seen the results before we received those emails, but let's talk about it.
Yeah.
I have an article here from Science Daily. Dietary supplement shows promise for reversing cardiovascular aging. So, you know, I read the headline. I said, gee, I wonder what they're talking about. Are they talking about CoQ10? Are they talking about magnesium? Are they talking about fish oil? And it turns out they're talking about nicotinamide riboside.
Yeah.
They say that it mimics caloric restriction. And that's a good thing, apparently, right?
Yes. More and more so.
Yeah, because they studies in fruit flies, roundworms, rodents, and even people have shown that chronically slashing intake by about a third can reap myriad health benefits. We have, of course, intermittent fasting and time-restricted feeding, cut the calories, restrict the time in which you're eating, and that kind of does a reboot on many of the systems in the body. And from an evolutionary standpoint, starvation was a regular feature of life, no longer. You know, except if, you know, you're a someone who undertakes regular fasting regimes, or in certain religions, of course, there's fasting holidays, and there's Lent.
Yes.
But few people really adhere to that. So this study was done at the University of Colorado at Boulder and Rocky Mountain High. And they say that when people consume a natural dietary supplement called nicotinamide riboside, it mimics caloric restriction. It kickstarts the same key chemical pathways responsible for health benefits. So what do they find in the study? They looked at a bunch of individuals, and this is actually one of the first times they did a study to see if it worked in humans. They took 500 milligrams twice daily dose. Well, okay, that is a little more than what I take regularly. I take 500 milligrams daily.
Yeah.
So that could get a little pricey, frankly.
Right.
So what they found was that 1,000 milligrams daily of nicotinamide riboside boosted levels of NADH by 60%. And that's sensational, because NADH is an energy compound par excellence in the heart, the brain. Every cell in the body needs NADH.
Yes.
So that's very cool.
And this is the first, and this study was aligned with those in the first human study published in late 2016. So they're very, very excited about it. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the scientists says the Colorado study is a landmark because it provides a beautiful placebo-controlled safety data at 1 gram of nicotinamide riboside per day, while also indicating that nicotinamide riboside has a potential to support healthy cardiovascular function.
Right, because what they found was that there were 13 participants who had elevated blood pressure, which was what's called stage 1 hypertension. Now they think that that's 120 to 139 over 80 to 89. That's a very stringent criterion for blood pressure. They moved the goalposts recently. They found that systolic blood pressure was 10 points lower after supplementation. And, you know, if you apply that to a real-world model, you get a 25% reduction in heart attack risk. So, you know, they think that this is exciting. You know, you can, you know, I'll be talking more about the study. And it's posted on Facebook. I think I shared that with our listeners. If not, I'll put it up there for those of you who follow us on Facebook. If there's anybody who still participates in Facebook after last couple of weeks, right?
Oh, yeah. That's another whole podcast.
That's the political
social
podcast.
Social media ruining your life?
Right, yeah. Right. Okay. So we'll stay away from that subject for the time being. Although we've done some podcasts, very interesting podcasts. One was on Glow Kids, it was called. It was a book about, you know, how kids are fixated on the media. We've done a couple of podcasts on how this is a major health threat because of, you know, just changing the way that, you know, attention deficit disorder thing, the way we think, and how, you know, how our impulse control, addiction, and sedentary lifestyle that engenders, you know, spending a lot of time on screen time instead of real world time roaming around like free range kids should. So anyway, so let's move on to questions. What do we got?
Okay. All right. We've got an email from Russell. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I'm 69, 5'10", 160-pound male. 6 years ago, I had an endoscopy due to GERD, and they found Barrett's esophagus. Mm-hmm. So for 6 years, I've been taking omeprazole.
Right. Let's explain. Barrett's esophagus is thought to be a precancerous lesion.
Yeah.
It's what's called metaplasia, which is a cell change that may be a precursor to cancer. So a question I ask a lot of patients who come to me with Barrett's is, so, okay, you know that this is called precancer, right? I mean, that's commonly the vernacular for Barrett's esophagus. I ask them, can you give me an estimate of what your chances are of developing esophageal cancer given that you have Barrett's? And I'll put that question to you, Layla, and maybe you already looked this up, so maybe you'll give me an educated answer. Mm. But typically patients will say, you know, 10%, sometimes 25%, sometimes 12%, you know, like a fairly high percentage. What would you, and so?
And so I would think it's about 1% to 2%.
Okay. So the actual answer is that it's about 0.1 to 0.2%. So it's more one in 1,000 or two in 1,000 go on to, you know, esophageal cancer, relatively uncommon cancer in the United States. I think there's about 30,000 cases. Of course, that's a big number. But, you know, given the population of the United States and the incidence of cancer. So, and, the incidence of Barrett's esophagus is so many times higher. So, unfortunately, when you get a diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus, it's such a high-stakes gamble that they want to put you on acid blockers for life because, God forbid, you'll develop esophageal cancer. Now, the problem is you have a very small likelihood of developing esophageal cancer, but you have a very high likelihood of developing one of the side effects of a lifetime prescription of a proton pump inhibitor, such as osteoporosis. And I'm holding here in my hands a study from a rheumatology journal, 2016, which concerns itself with bones and joints and osteoporosis. and it's called Proton Pump Inhibitors and Osteoporosis. They did a review, and they found that the new studies have further strengthened existing evidence linking use of PPIs to osteoporosis. And even short-term use does not appear to pose a lower risk than long-term use.
That's interesting.
So yeah. The use of PPIs, they say in the summary, is a risk factor for development of osteoporosis and osteoporotic fractures. So they don't even know precisely why. They think it has something to do with absorption of calcium, and maybe it has something to do with a definite factor associated with osteoporosis, with PPIs, which is magnesium. And magnesium is a factor in bone. So it's very common to see magnesium deficiency in people taking these medications, which puts them at higher risk for heart trouble.
So to complicate matters, Russell, the 69-year-old man with Barrett's, now with osteoporosis, found that his hiatal hernia got larger, and now he needs surgery.
So he needs what's called a Nissen, it's called a Nissen fundoplication. It's a surgery to kind of tighten that up a little bit.
So for the past year, he's been taking strontium, bone up. He's taking vitamin K2. He's taking good amounts of vitamin D, hoping that it will help his bones.
Has it yet?
So, Well, doesn't know yet because he has to go for another DEXA scan at some point. And he's wondering how soon after the first one. I would say at least a year.
Year and perhaps two. Now, he's being offered osteoporosis medication. Is that correct?
That's right.
Certain of the osteoporosis medication might be problematic in somebody with Barrett's because it can be an irritant to the esophagus. So, you know, these, Fosamax, Boniva, these are potentially irritating the esophagus. I don't know if they can increase the risk of esophageal cancer necessarily, but they're not that well tolerated.
So Dr. Hoffman, get this. Russell recently, while he was eating bread, noticed some pain in his chest when swallowing. So he says, I called the GI and he said I should restart the omeprazole because you can't go into the surgery with an inflamed esophagus. Apparently, Russell was never counseled on how to eat for GERD.
Also, he, you know, he abruptly withdrew the acid blocking medication when he developed osteoporosis. And you have to, you can't do that too quickly. It's very hard to taper because there's a rebound effect and the body overproduces acid. So, it's really kind of an art. You know, we've, you know, as well as I do that when we have patients who want to get off PPIs, we have to do it very slowly and gradually with a supportive diet, certain supplements like, DGL and Endofen, aloe. Certain of these things help to reduce the rebound effect.
So,
So the question is, ultimately, can he keep taking the supplements
With the omeprazole?
And the answer is yes. And that's the best he can do for now,
That's the best he could do for now,
And let's see, are any of those supplements potential irritants, do you think? Probably strontium's pretty mild.
It's pretty mild, you know, sometimes calcium is a problem, but with the omeprazole, he's not absorbing enough of it.
And of course, we need to check, we need to talk about vitamin D and make sure that he has adequate levels, you know, by testing.
Vitamin D, he's taking some D, he's taking some K2. Yeah, he needs to be counseled on how to eat because his hiatal hernia had enlarged since a previous endoscopy 3 years ago. So this is a workup. Russell,
But, I mean, it gives just this, our discussion, our dialogue can give people a little bit of an idea how we integrative or functional doctors think about these types of problems. And so, you know, the question ultimately, though, is even if he has a relief of his symptoms, will he need to remain on the proton pump inhibitors for a lifetime? And that's kind of an open question because we have actually had a few patients who've gone off their proton pump inhibitors, and there are supplements that are helpful for Barrett's esophagus. Among them, higher doses of folate can be helpful. EGCG from green tea has anti-cancer effects. We really like DIM, for that, which I think we have a question about, diindolmethane, which is a potent anti-cancer derivative of broccoli and cruciferous vegetables. And you know, what are some of the other things that might be cancer protective there? You know, without burdening someone who already has heartburn with too many supplements, we want to kind of limit the overdosing on too many supplements, because those too can be an irritant.
Exactly, exactly. There can also be some reversal of the Barrett's esophagus, but it appears to me from Russell's email that he was never counseled on how to eat properly for the GERD.
Yeah.
And that in itself can take away a lot of his symptoms, and taking DGL. You know, taking 6, 8, 12 DGL a day as a can be greatly helpful. So,
Okay, so there's a variety of options for him. But, you know, look, frankly, I got to say, once you have a really bad hiatal hernia, and it's so bad that they're contemplating surgery, sometimes you have to have surgery because you have what's called an incompetent esophageal, what do you call it, the esophageal valve.
And the sphincter.
The sphincter, exactly, the sphincter. And so the sphincter gets flabby. I mean, it's kind of like when an old sock, you know, the elastic runs out, you know, your socks fall down, you know, so you can't give vitamins to your socks to make them tighten up, you know, it's done, you know, it's over, game over. So you have to do a tightening procedure.
Yeah. All right. Best of luck to you, Russell. Wow.
Yep.
And now, speaking of DIM, all right, we've got an email from Mark. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I'm currently taking Indole 3-carbinol twice daily. I have seen some impressive results with improvements in lean body mass and body fat reduction. I know there is great debate as to the greater benefits of I3C versus DIM. What is your opinion on the debate? I'm a 57-year-old man.
It is a debate, and it's been going on for a long time. In fact, you know, as you posed the question, I Googled it, and there's an article entitled I3C versus DIM, dated January 2002. And so let's explain what we're talking about. DIM is actually formed naturally when I3C, indole 3-carbinol, is broken down in the gut.
Yes. Okay?
So, you know, so it would stand to reason that if you want more bioavailable stuff, you're gonna administer DIM. Okay.
Yeah. Another analogy to that would be taking glutathione rather than just NAC and acetylcysteine. Or something, but
you know, and I have to say that a lot of the information that's on the internet about I3C versus DIM, if you Google it for the controversy, you'll see that there's sometimes a bias, like a company that is the maker of I3C will knock DIM, and vice versa. A company that has made the decision to market DIM exclusively will knock I3C, and then there's some companies that take a middle ground. They offer a 50-50 product, a little DIM and a little I3C, you know, just cover their, you know, send us.
So they like them both.
It's squaring off the middle.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, here's the thing I would say to Mark, since he's already seen some impressive results in himself with improvements in lean body mass and body fat, just keep taking the I3C.
Yeah.
But you could also alternate with the DIM, certainly.
And you know, then there may be a cost factor, and I, you know, I don't know which is more economical.
There is that. Okay, but I also want to clarify something here. It sounds from Mark's email that the I3C that he's taking is the reason he's seeing improvements in lean body mass, body fat. I'm sure that can't be the only thing that Mark is doing. And Mark, do write us back if this is not the case. I imagine you're already exercising, you're eating a cleaner diet, in addition to taking the indole 3-carbinol, and you're seeing these impressive results.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you found the magic bullet.
Yep. One of the knocks against I3C, it's claimed that it's unstable. It can transform into many other non-dim substances. And that so, therefore, you want to skip the dim step and go directly to the, I'm sorry, skip the I3C step and go directly to the dim step.
It's dim.
And so, you know, I got to say, it's one of those perplexing controversies. You know, what, see, here's the only mechanism that I can think of for why he thinks he's losing weight with dim. And that is because some men develop estrogenic kind of fat. You know how hard it is for women to get a washboard abdomen, or they put fat on their hips and breasts and they have sort of soft contours. That's because of estrogen. And men make some estrogen, and especially certain men, aromatize their estrogen, I mean, their testosterone to estrogen.
Yeah.
And that sometimes causes them to not be as shredded as they'd like and, not have too much subcutaneous fat. More in a female predominance, even gynecomastia. And so DIM seems to have an impact on estrogen metabolism. That's why we use it for breast cancer survivors, prevention of breast cancer. We'll use DIM sometimes. I'm sorry.
Estrogen dominance.
Yeah.
Or perhaps women
who take estrogen. You know, maybe we're giving them estrogen and we want to safeguard them from adverse effects of estrogen. You know, so that, I think, is the only... I don't think in any way DIM has been shown to be thermogenic or calorie burning, to my knowledge, anyway. I don't think that's a big part of why it might help weight in men.
Right. Okay. Well, Mark... keep up the great work.
Yeah, something's working anyway. So it's like
something's working, right?
And you know what? Even if it's not responsible for your weight loss, keep on taking it because it is. It has a beneficial effect on the prostate as well. So you know, it could be protective there as well. And that's
wonderful.
That's such a big potential problem for men that it's. I think it's warranted to take it as part of your preventive program. Layla, I think we're. Due for a break because we divide these podcasts
already?
In two parts. Yeah, time flies and you're having fun.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep.
My goodness.
It really does.
Okay.
So give us a preview of what we're going to be talking about in part two, please.
I'm currently taking warfarin. Is there any interaction with the L-theanine I take for anxiety?
Okay. Wow. All right. Important question. Let's tackle that in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Layla Mutin, who's our nutritionist in residence. She's a licensed nutritionist in New York, as well as a possessor of a registered dietitian RD degree, and has gone on to advanced studies, obtaining a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And there you have it. She's my capable sidekick in these weekly Q&As. And so we'll be right back with more of our weekly Q&A with Layla podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Telligen Medicine.